Committee of Higher Education and Workforce Development will be in order. Today's date is Thursday, February 12th. So just a few things. We thank all those who are here on time for being on time and apologize for our tardy start. We don't have a quorum yet, but I trust we will have one shortly, so we'll go ahead and begin. In the Higher Ed Committee, we have a QRS code. Did I say that correctly? My advisors aren't sitting here, but there's a code on your agenda so that if you want to get the documents for today's agenda, you can use your mobile device to do that, and it will pull up the things. If you're using an iPad, you cannot scan the code, and so there you must go to the website, which is listed on your agenda. So it is our goal to slow...
You can scan the code.
With your iPad?
Absolutely.
Oh, great.
We just got to download an app, but
okay.
Free app.
Senator Miller, thank you. And just so people are aware, it is our intention eventually to be paperless, so we're trying to train people to move towards scanning the QRS code so we can get there. Is Brett Anderson here? And so people understand, there were questions given to the trustees ahead of time as we asked them to just use these questions as a framework for introduction. Give me that. So the question number one is, a board of trustees charged with governing the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. How do you envision the role of a trustee in governing the system? What principles and ideas will guide you in fulfilling this role? Number two, Chancellor Rosenstone, as well as other leaders, has identified that Minnesota will have a workforce shortage within the next 5 years. How do you plan on helping Chancellor Rosenstone in partnership with the state of Minnesota grapple with this shortage? Number three, as trustee, what impact do you hope to have on the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities? And we've allotted for no more than 5 minutes per applicant. And so Maya, we'll make sure and let you know if your time is up. So with that, introduce yourself for the record, please.
All right. Thank you, Chair Bonhoff and members. For the record, I am Brett K. Anderson. And it is with great pleasure that I can introduce myself to you today after serving as University Student Trustee for the last year and a half. I actually just had a good laugh looking at your packet of materials and how outdated that information is. But I currently live in Rosemount, Minnesota, and am pursuing a master's degree in nursing from Metropolitan State University and received a bachelor's in nursing from Minnesota State Mankato. And from 2004 to 2006, was a concurrent enrollment student with Southwest Minnesota State. So in one way, shape, or form or another, I've been a MinSCU student for the last 10 years. I practice nursing here in St. Paul as an independent nurse contract nurse and consultant, and I'm also an adjunct nursing instructor at St. Paul College. I think it's incumbent upon trustees to act as fiduciaries and stewards of the system on behalf of all people of the state of Minnesota. However, as a student trustee, I have a vested interest in not only representing the citizens of Minnesota, but the 1 in 13 Minnesota residents that are students within the system, and specifically the over 76,000 students at one of our seven state universities. Trustees are setting the strategic direction for moving the system forward in new and powerful directions. In fulfilling the role of a trustee, I have and will continue to rely upon the principles and ideas that pushed me to seek the trustee position. First, the landscape of higher education is changing. The funding paradigm has shifted, but the main principle guiding me is a fundamental belief of the economic value of higher education. Minnesota has been home to the most Fortune 500 companies per capita, thanks to a well-trained, highly skilled workforce that was able to attain a high-quality and affordable education. I'm concerned about our workforce in the years ahead and the affordability of higher education. I've suffered through the shift and the economic downturn, and I'm troubled by the number of my peers who aren't buying homes or starting businesses, but are moving home with parents, working jobs they had in college or in high school, and are saddled with debt. I often wonder how affordable higher education will be for my brother, Adam, a junior in high school. And as a potential lifelong resident of Minnesota, what kind of higher education system and affordability can I expect for my children? Secondly, student demographics are changing. At precisely the same time that we know that Minnesota needs more graduates with certificates and degrees, we are not only dealing with the challenges of the burdensome funding shift, but we're facing a changing Minnesota. More and more of our students will be underrepresented. These students must obtain post-secondary education. Closing the achievement gap, as I know you are all well aware of, is a strategic priority, and the future economic success of Minnesota depends on it. Hoping to influence higher education policy around these challenges and other challenges, I sought the trustee position. The guidelines and ideas guiding me as a trustee can be found in our strategic framework, which we worked and developed right as I was coming on the board, and I've adopted it 100%. To ensure access to an extraordinary education for all Minnesotans is our first priority and my first guiding priority. I believe the Minsky system is the place of opportunity where all Minnesotans can come to obtain a degree, update skills, or seek new training. I believe as a trustee, it's incumbent that I work to ensure future students not only have the same access and the same extraordinary education that I had and continue to have, but in fact have a better one. Last year, while the board was deliberating our committee structure and internal organization, I lobbied hard to preserve our Diversity and Equity Committee, and this year I serve as vice chair of that committee. I'm proud to say the committee has taken leadership in taking a frank assessment of where we stand regarding access, opportunity, and closing the achievement gap, and we are implementing best practices, setting aggressive standards, goals, and pushing for outcomes. We're working hard to ensure our doors are open and also ensuring that we have the systems in place to ensure once they're inside our doors, they're able to leave with the degree or skills that they sought in a timely and efficient manner. The second guiding principle, and the second one in our strategic framework, is to be the partner of choice to meet Minnesota's workforce and community needs. I hire our graduates. So as a trustee, I certainly understand that a guiding principle should be to ensure our system is working to develop graduates with real-world problem-solving skills to meet the demands of jobs today and tomorrow. And finally, to deliver to students, employers, and communities and taxpayers the highest value and absolutely most affordable option. I'm committed to working towards a higher education system that can support a healthy and vibrant economy. A dynamic and responsive education system is simply the best economic engine for the future vitality of our state. Yet, our students must be able to afford it, and it must be of value to communities and taxpayers. A sustainable and affordable system is an asset for generations to come. To address your questions regarding future workforce challenges, not only is our student demographic shifting, but inherently and eventually our employee demographics will shift. Our Diversity and Equity Committee later this spring is taking up the issue and looking at it in depth, and it will certainly be a strategic priority for us to come. But it's my assessment that the system will need to solve this in partnership with the state and with you folks, especially in high demand and high growth fields. My field, for example, nursing is one of them. You can make more money working as a private nurse than you can teaching. Add on the expense of a graduate degree, and it doesn't make sense. We have to figure out a way to get qualified, motivated faculty in fields that are in high demand. While on the board, I've had the opportunity to visit 19 of our 31 institutions. I've been blown away, but let me say not clearly surprised by the talent, commitment, creativity, and passion of our students, faculty, staff, and administration. The opportunity to shape the future of the system and higher education policy on behalf of students and citizens of Minnesota has been quite simply an honor and a real passion. It's been an educational and humbling experience. In my remaining months, I hope to continue to leverage my decade of student experience to bring credibility to the student perspective, to represent students and all citizens with the highest level of integrity, and to collaborate together to develop creative and innovative solutions which move our system forward towards our strategic vision. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Anderson. Are there questions? Very good. Thank you. So next, we'd like to hear from Mr. Cirillo. Mr. Cirillo.
For the record, my name is Alexander Cirillo, Chairman, members of the committee. I'm a 3M retiree, retired 2 years ago, 31 years with the company. Started as a PhD chemist. They hired me as a physicist. Worked for 17 years in laboratories. Ran several of 3M's businesses, was the president and general manager of 3M Canada, and then at the end of my career for the last 5 years was the vice president of the 3M Foundation. As the chair, as the head of the 3M Foundation, which is where I really got connected with education, 50% of what we did in the United States was around education, either K through 12 specifically and things with higher education. As far as the questions are concerned, the role of the board on governance and principles, our role clearly is to provide oversight, bring financial and operational on the benefit of the state. We're also responsible for good decision-making in matters prescribed by statute. The board also has the responsibility to help plan the future of MNSCU in meeting the needs of the state, and that's probably the most important thing that we're doing now. The principles are basically the principles of good governance, transparency, respect for the needs of our students, respect for the needs of our organizations, and these should guide us in our governance, and we should also be aware of what the state needs. We're also responsible for assuring good management practices and holding the state or holding the organization accountable. Where possible, I hope to share the perspectives of the private sector with the MNSCU system. One of the things I do as a retiree is I teach innovation around the country. And innovation insofar as organizational principles are necessary for that. So one of the things I'm hoping to apply is to understand how the organization is set up today, what the future of education looks like, and then look what the system needs to do to become an innovative educator. I also plan to advocate for MNSCU wherever I can, obviously. To play a role in making the board an effective governing body is really what I would hope would be the end state here, and also to help MNSCU realize its vision of becoming the next generational educational system for the state itself. Are there any questions?
Well, Mr. Cirillo, thank you very much, and I think bringing that perspective to MNSCU is something that is very exciting to hear, and I think you are fortunate to be working with administration that shares your commitment to innovation and understands the uncertain future for higher education but has a passion for designing that future.
I think they're on that page, and they should be on that page.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So next, Ms. Erlinson, sorry, I know that too.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. For the record, I am Dawn Erlinson. Thank you for inviting me today. I'm honored to have been appointed to serve on the Board of Trustees of the MNSCU system. Like many MNSCU students, I was the first in my extended family to go to college and was raised by a single mom. I grew up in Cassin, Minnesota, and now live in Minneapolis. For the past 7 years, I have owned a small business. Prior to that, I worked for two small businesses and started and ran two nonprofit organizations, one here and one in Washington, D.C. I am married, and I have two children in Minneapolis public schools. They attend one of the most diverse schools in the state. This diversity is mirrored at Minneapolis Community and Technical College, where I served on the foundation board for 7 years, two as chair. And I want to recognize President Phil Davis, who's in the audience, for his leadership of MCTC. This experience has prepared me well to serve on the Board of Trustees. The board serves a number of critical roles, including oversight of the system, setting policy, and holding the chancellor accountable for results. I believe it is our unique duty to represent the people of Minnesota and their many interests as taxpayers, employers, citizens, and students. And finally, we have the wonderful opportunity to travel the state and meet the students, faculty, and staff at campuses all over the state. I am guided by the principles of access, affordability, and quality. We are well aware that a critical challenge facing us is the workforce of the future and ensuring that we prepare students for the jobs and careers that will keep Minnesota's economy strong And Minsky is particularly well situated for this because we're the system that trains the police officers, the nurses, the health technicians, and the like. This has been and remains a key focus area for the chancellor and the trustees. I am serving on a system task force on the education of the future that is focusing in part on workforce preparedness, and there's also a task force focused particularly on the workforce. I hope that during my term that I will be able to work with you, my fellow trustees, the chancellor, and his team to ensure that Minnesotans receive the highest quality education at an affordable price that prepares them well for their future and ours. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Erlinson? Good. Well, I thank you very much for being willing to serve in that role, and thank you. You too will be a great asset.
Thank you.
Yes. So at this time, actually, why don't we have all three of you come back to the podium so we can entertain a motion? Mr. Anderson, I was very impressed with your resume of excellence in your studies as well, so thank you. Yes.
Before you entertain a motion, I have had a question rolling around in my head. If you don't mind, I'd like
sure,
to ask
please.
Any of these qualified people to talk about this. I must say that I think they're all just absolutely fabulous. Thank you for serving, but I have to speak for Mr. Anderson, who is a graduate of Minnesota State University Mankato School of Nursing, which is where I used to be a faculty member. So I just have to mention that. And he walked how many times to the two times
Twice
from
center.
Mankato to this Capitol with the Student Association from Mankato, can you imagine that, to advocate for students and for concerns about tuition and resources. So, pardon, and he's an athlete? You can speak to that if you'd like to. My question
Well, he just said, Senator Sheridan, he just said I needed nursing after that.
That's right, they did, too, and shoes. My question, though, is, you're talking about, in your comments, the vision, the strategic objectives of MNSCU, what it is that collectively we need to work on through the MNSCU system. But I have a couple of questions, and that is, there has been
to have this program in this area or the duplication here. And so I think the chancellor, with some of our oversight, has been very intentional about looking at the programmatics of it. And then we're certainly looking at the administrative side of it as well.
Very good. Any other comments, questions? Okay, members, you do have Trustee Irvinson.
Senator Sharon, thank you for asking. Most large organizations could become more efficient at the administrative level, including large companies as well as government and even small business. And I think the chancellor and his team have had the foresight to put this campus service cooperative together, and they're doing things like bulk purchasing, like Walmart has done, for example, for all campuses. They're consolidating payroll, and so they don't necessarily have the same function at every college and university campus if they don't need to. As Trustee Cirillo said, sometimes you do want things decentralized, but in the case of certain services and purchasing, they're trying to take advantage of the size of the system, and they're even working with other educational institutions on purchasing, for example. And this has started quite some time ago. It's not a recent development.
Seems to me that MNSCU has actually led the way with regard to some of these back office shared service functions.
Absolutely,
and
true in Minnesota.
And that's something that I've been actually pushing at the legislature for the K-12 system, and so I've been pleased to watch what MNSCU is doing. I'm also curious, and I'm sure the chancellor will speak to this, but I think what's interesting is, okay, that's the back office side. How about the functional side of programmatic specificity. I didn't say, you know, you got what I meant. Thank you. Whereby you say, you know, do all campuses have to deliver all programs? What's the right mix to have, you know, what programs where? Where do you specialize? Where do you be broad to make sure we're using our dollars most wisely? And I think that is going to be in the future of redesign, and I expect we'll hear about that. So good question. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. And this, I haven't heard this year in the Senate anyway, but this pulse that I'm talking about, that ever since we've gone to a MNSCU system rather than each individual campus, mm-hmm. is this tension between whether when you get your budget, where are you expending those resources? Are you growing the administration and the MNSCU office activities, or are you using those to support faculty and faculty resources on the campus? That's what I'm talking about, is part of that pulse. And it seems to me that there's a constant kind of tension, which is always the case. Our divisions fight over targets of dollars and where they should be spent. But in terms of the role of the members of the board, MNSCU board, in terms of, you know, I think about the board as an oversight that's going to ask the questions that really challenge whether or not we're having excessive growth in the central office of administration that's using resources that are needed on each of the campuses to achieve their objectives. So that's what I'm asking you about. Do you see that happening? Do you commit yourself to that kind of role on the
Mr.
board?
Anderson. Trustee Anderson.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, last year, since I had the privilege of being on the board, and Trustees Cirillo and Irwinson did not have that privilege, that process went, I think that's a continual process, you know, that we're overseeing at budget time with the chancellor. But specifically last year, I don't recall the exact meeting, but, you know, we went back and looked and, you know, ended up taking, you know, 5% out of our own budget, extra money out of some of the different system office function areas. And that system office spending has gone down quite a bit. And I can honestly say, as a student, I'm quite happy with the level of administration. And I know that our chancellor quite often, with board oversight too, you know, says that if a function is better left to the campus, it will be on the campus. And only things that make us more efficient will be done at the system office. I've heard that for years as a student. And now that I'm right inside the thick of it, I can say that I absolutely agree with that assessment, that we are lean, I think, at the system office. And whatever can be sent out to campuses to meet the needs of students is being out there. And so maybe that's why the pulse isn't so strong, presently this year. They're pretty lean over there, and it's only value-added functions. Thank you.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Cirillo.
Senator,
Trustee
my perception Cirillo. Coming in as a first look was the benchmark against other campuses that I was aware of outside the state. And our administration is less than that and has decreased over the past two or three years. So I think that there's a balance there. And I think from what I've seen, Chancellor Rosenstone has done a good job in terms of controlling what's going on centrally, but also recognizing what has to go into the system itself. There's a knee-jerk reaction that you can have to say we want nothing in the center of the organization. If you have nothing in the center of the organization, you have no collaboration, and you have no way for the organization to function as one. Then what happens? It's warring tribes. So you do need a strong central coordination to give the vision and to basically make sure that everyone is working for the Minnesota State business rather than working as independent contractors.
And Senator Sharon. Just my last comment is I'm hearing you assure that you have a lot of confidence about how decisions are being made in terms of where resources are allocated and whether or not you have the proper level of administration. I'm even more assured if I believe that you take the role of making sure that that examination is occurring, because we can't make that examination. That's an expectation that we're counting on from board members to actively engage in that process. Otherwise, we'll start getting, I think, too much into the weeds of your budget and your activity.
Yep. One final comment, Lindsay. Madam Chair, Senator Sharon. And I'm sorry, I saw Senator Kent. I'm like, you're not Senator Kent. The name tags are in the wrong place.
I'll answer the most any name.
One important innovation, which I mentioned earlier, which I wasn't clear about, in the campus service cooperative, thank you, a collaborative cooperative. For example, the payroll functions that are being centralized are not being centralized at the Minsku headquarters. They're citing these things on campuses. So jobs are staying out around the state, and different campuses have the opportunity to have expertise in different areas where it makes sense to have a centralization of function. And I think that's a great model, because everything doesn't need to reside in St. Paul. And so I think that's an innovation that's important. Also, I'd like to mention, in my interview with the governor, I stated that ideally as many resources as possible should be for instruction. And I'm certainly well aware, as a parent in a school system, I don't see that in the school system where I have my children, but I certainly see it at the Minsky from what I know so far. But thank you for reminding us of that duty. It's really important. And we'll stay on it.
And
the board do this work? How do you ensure that you are connecting with those communities? Are you relying on these board members that are minorities, and are they a voice or not?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Erlinson.
Senator, the Board of Trustees is a volunteer organization, or we're all volunteers, and we don't see ourselves on the front line of connecting with communities and students as our primary duty. We do have the opportunity to go out and visit campuses and meet students and talk to family members, and we all try to do that, and we do it around the state. My most direct experience is with Minneapolis Community and Technical College, where I served on the foundation board for 7 years, and it's a highly diverse school. If you're involved with a particular campus, you have more opportunity to engage more directly with families, and I know that a number of administration members, faculty, and city leaders in Minneapolis have been very active going into schools, for example, in Minneapolis, and talking to families about colleges. Opportunity for all people, and the Power of You program, which is a free education for high school graduates of Minneapolis and St. Paul schools, and I think that's getting broader now, has really helped families who had never had someone go to college to be able to realize that they too can go to college, and the stories that we've heard from students who felt like my only opportunity was to drive a taxi cab, and now I can go to MCTC and be anything I want to be. A lot of that outreach work is done at the campus level and not so much at the system level or by the trustees. But it's important for us to stay involved and in touch with current students, with future students, with employers, and with community leaders of all kinds.
Well, trustees, I might also mention this in line with Senator Torres-Ray's comments is that as trustees that we would hope that you would hold the administration accountable for fulfilling the mission, the overall vision and mission of MNSCU, one of which is serving underserved populations. And so it seems to me that, you know, I might, sitting in your shoes, that might spark a question, like what are our overall objectives with regard to that? And I think we even had a performance objective with regard to that.
It is.
And thank you. And so, and have we put enough teeth into the performance objectives so that we really do fulfill that part of the MNSCU mission? And if not, how might we do that, and how might we expand that? Mr. Anderson?
Thank you, Chair Bonhoff and Senator Torres-Ray. I'm the Vice Chair of the Diversity and Equity Committee, as I alluded to in my remarks, and I think this year we're really looking in depth about, underrepresented students, the achievement gap, opportunity, access, all those issues you talked about. And they're so unique because it's not just maybe a different ethnic group, but also our communities and just the locality of them are unique in and of themselves. You take like Minnesota West and Worthington, and there's some interesting demographics there. So we're going really in depth, and I think you can be assured that we're setting some pretty aggressive targets. The chair of the committee, Trustee Dixon, and I have said, I think it's okay if we aim high, and if we do miss, we miss. But we have hit some pretty good targets. So I think we're really taking a good look at that and trying to make sure that we're meeting the needs of those communities and connect with them as trustees when we can, but do rely on our staff and the campuses to do that as much as they can.
Thank you. Yes.
Chair and Senator, I think you also have to take into account the individuals who are on the board themselves. Many of us have experiences in some of those communities. For example, I mentor in a program called STEP, which is on the east side of St. Paul, run by 3M, provides mentors, supervisors, and jobs to children of color and also socioeconomic disparities. Those are the things that we bring to this, and we see those through the eyes. So when the Committee for Diversity and Equity basically presents to the board, we're asking questions or relating to the experiences that we have in the community. So I work with MNSCU, or with MNCAN, also work with the STEP program and several other programs in the Minneapolis Public Schools. We bring that as part of the lens through which we look at how the university is, how the Minsky system is actually operating.
Follow-up, Senator Torres-Ray?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I do want to, you know, I appreciate the work that you do. I want to encourage you to really look at this issue of how do you learn about communities, how you participate in communities. For me, coming to the Senate and going to Senator Miller's district with the former Senator Erickson Robes, who represented the district, and going to Senator Sharon's district to really learn about how community colleges are so important to the communities and how low-income families in their communities really, you know, struggle. And the lessons that I have learned, for instance, in Senator Sharon's district is, you know, the number of kids from my district who are coming to Mankato and who feel so welcome and how they have invested tremendous resources in doing community outreach. So we have a lot of city people going to study in her district. And then for me to learn in Senator Miller about, you know, income gaps in your community and how important it was for me to speak about what it means to work, you know, 14 hours a day and having to think about school and then having, you know, $25,000 income in terms of a rural community. I always talk about urban. So it's just so important that we learn those lessons, and I do think that there is a lot of value in bringing, you know, the trustees to that level and having hearings in different communities and learning what is happening. It makes a big difference.
And we appreciate what you three bring to bear on that issue. Yes, Ms. Trustee Erlinson.
Madam Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, one additional thought. The workforce question that you asked us, we are well aware that the population of Minnesota is changing dramatically and that it is imperative upon us to reach out to all people of Minnesota, particularly those who, for whom there is not a tradition of higher education, because there aren't that many jobs coming in the future that pay people well enough if they don't have some form of higher education or training. And so the system is working on it, the campuses are working on it, and our community partners, the businesses, and the K-12 systems, I think, are hopefully working together to make sure we're reaching everyone in Minnesota, because we're all better off if everyone has opportunity to learn. And I was one of the rural kids that came to the city to go to college, so it's fun to see people going back and forth. Thank you.
Very good. And members, the ones who are up for confirmation who are not here today, they have written answers to the questions that were submitted, and they're in their packet. And so I appreciate staff for making sure that to send that out and that each one of them did get that back. So if there, and let the record reflect there is a quorum. If there are no other questions, I might entertain them.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, Senator Fischbach. I called on you before and didn't get back to you. I apologize.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just curious, are we going to have the opportunity, since you did mention the packet, are we going to have the opportunity to have those four in front of the committee? And at least, because Senator Torres-Ray, Senator Sharon had very good questions, and we had answers and discussions that you can't get from a piece of paper. And I'm just wondering if we are going to have the opportunity to have those four here.
Senator Fischbach, it was my intention, thinking that that we would just take the written. I am open to doing something different. I doesn't, you know, it's up to the will of the committee. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, Madam Chair, is it unusual that we would not have them at least be here?
That was my understanding. but can some.
Madam Chair, Senator Fischbach, it's not unusual that nominees don't show up. It's a mixed bag.
That was my understanding. I asked that question, was told that often just some are here and not all. But I prefer to have to hear from each one of them as well. So I leave it to the will of the committee. We can certainly pass those who are here today and reserve another time for the others to come. Senator Sharon.
I don't know. So that you can hear what we're what we're concerned about, that you execute in your role. And so maybe, you know, there have been times when we've been invited to meet with the board members for this kind of a conversation periodically. We don't want to get into their business or start administrating, but this conversation with board members is, I've always found it really, really important. So if we can't do it in this way with individuals, maybe there's another way we can accomplish it.
Well, members, this is what I would suggest. We have two options, and I'm going to list them both, and then I'd like to hear from members so that we can get a sense and build consensus, and I don't have an agenda with regard to the answer. One option is to go ahead and move them as a slate and then require or strongly request that those who are not here come in a subsequent hearing and hear from them. Another option is to only move who's in front of us and let those other trustees know that until they're here, we don't, you know, we're not ready to move them. So I guess I'd like to hear from members. And again, the chair has no opinion.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Senator Fischbach.
I'm curious if there were options given, or was it one date, then show up, or that this is it, or how did the...
Mr. Kornacki.
Madam Chair, thank you. Multiple days were given, and this worked for some. I had some have to cancel at last minute. I was expecting four of the seven, but someone had a last minute thing come up. So we thought we had at least the majority. A lot of them are doing work on behalf of us in Washington, D.C. right now.
Thank you.
Senator Wortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's no time restriction for us to act on confirming...
Nope.
Candidates, and so I would hope that we would extend another invitation for them to come. I'd be very comfortable with the folks that have come today.
Great.
But I'd like to have more of an introduction to the others before we are asked to vote.
Okay. Anybody on an opposing side want to make a different argument? Okay. And the one benefit I see to that is I think when we have a conversation with future trustees, that we actually do have a chance to shape perhaps their thinking as they go forward in their new role in particular, because you never know what comes out of a discussion. And so people do walk away with a different direction. And I think that we as legislators do have a critical role in shaping policy. So I think there's benefit to that. So with that, I'll entertain a motion.
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Klassen.
I move that the appointments of Brett Anderson, Alexander Cirillo Jr., and Dawn Erlinson to the Board of Trustees of the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities are recommended for confirmation.
All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next we are pleased to hear the budget request from the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. So Chancellor Rosenstone and Chair Hightower will join us. Chancellor.
Chair Bonhoff, members of the committee, it's a great pleasure to be back with you again today. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss Minnesota State Colleges and Universities' legislative request, a request that is focusing on serving Minnesotans from all walks of life to ensure they have access to an extraordinary education that prepares them for the jobs and careers they need to serve communities across Minnesota. We're committed to educating skilled workers and professionals needed to ensure Minnesota's vitality. Teachers and first responders, engineers and machinists, the entrepreneurs and city managers, the business leaders and nurses. And we are committed to meeting the needs of all students. Every one of the 430,000 students we serve has a story to share. It may have taken a working mother 6 years to earn her associate's degree because she could only take one or two courses at a time while raising her children and working full-time, but we call her story a success. And we're committed to scaling up the best practices across our system to enable great things to happen and every one of our college and universities to improve the success of all of our students. Madam Chair, before we go forward, I'd like to not only acknowledge the trustees that you've spoken with already today, but acknowledge the chair of our Board of Trustees, Clarence Hightower, who, with your permission, I'll invite to join the conversation in just a few moments. But we also have with us today several of our presidents, President Sue Hammersmith from Metro State University, Phil Davis from Minneapolis Community and Technical College, John O'Brien from North Hennepin Community College, Kent Hansen, who's interim president of Riverland Community College, and Russell Desmond, who's president of St. Paul College.
Can I ask the presidents to stand to be recognized so we see who you are? Very good. Thank you for being here.
I would also like to acknowledge Vice Chancellor and CFO Laura King, who's with us today, and might be the person I'll call for the lifeline if the questions are of those nature.
Very good. Thank you.
I would also like to recognize the dedicated faculty and students who are here in the audience. I'd like you to know that our students, both student organizations, support the legislative request that we'll be discussing with you today that's been advanced by the Board of Trustees. And as the trustees have already indicated to you, we are indeed committed to delivering to our students, as well as communities and taxpayers across the state, the highest value, most affordable higher education available in Minnesota. This past year, we joined with DEED, we joined with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and other partners to hold over 50 listening sessions around the state, to meet with over 650 business leaders to help us understand the workforce needs of the future, both the technical and foundational skills, such as teamwork and communication and creativity and analytical capacity and the like, that's really needed for Minnesota to thrive. This past year, I also listened to students and faculty and our staff who participated in forums on every one of our college and university campuses, forums designed to identify the steps needed to take great programs and make them extraordinary, and take extraordinary programs and make them preeminent. I listened to our savvy staff identify opportunities for improving efficiency and boosting the quality of the work we do. And I listened to our presidents and chief academic officers and deans and diversity officers describe the next steps we should take to improve student success and improve the quality of the education we provide our students. Throughout my first year as chancellor, I listened. I listened to better understand the answer to the question, what does Minnesota need to prosper? A prosperous Minnesota is within our reach, but only if we work together. And the proposal we'll be discussing today reflects the collaboration required for Minnesota's success. Madam Chair, before I turn the podium over to Chair Hightower, I thought I'd give a quick overview of the game plan. After Chair Hightower shares with you the board's priorities, I want to very mercifully, briefly, review where we left off last time by focusing on the challenges facing Minnesota and the outcomes we need to produce to meet those challenges. And for my apologies, with less mercy and less brief, I want to spend some time talking about the three legislative priorities to advance the competitiveness of Minnesota's workforce, to increase access and affordability, and to accelerate completion. So with your permission, I'd like to invite Chair Hightower to address the committee.
Very good. And we share your priorities, so we're glad to have that discussion. So, Chair Hightower.
Thank you, Chancellor Rosenstone. Madam Chair, members, my name is Clarence Hightower, and I currently serve as Chair of the Board of Trustees for the Minnesota State College and University System. And let me, and on behalf of the members of the Minnesota Board of Trustees, thank you for the opportunity to be part of today's discussion. Let me begin my comments by saying that we listened intently in the back there as you had the conversation with our three colleagues, and we appreciate that, and we thank you for considering them to be colleagues on the Board of Trustees. I believe that they will be terrific colleagues, and in many cases they have already demonstrated that. I did want to respond at least in part to one of the questions, and we know that we'll respond more fully when you talk to our other colleagues that have come before you. But one of the questions was, and I appreciate so much you asking the question, but one of the questions was about the system and how it is or is not growing. And let me just say definitively that the system office is absolutely not growing. Let me just offer up just 3 points of information that caused me to make that statement. First of all, over the last 4 years, the system is 24% smaller today than it was 4 years ago. In addition to that, over the last decade, the system has gone from 3.7% of the total down to 2.2% of the total budget. And then finally, the final information I would lift up today is that of the 50 or so systems across the country, our system is 37th when you look at it in most expensive to least expensive in terms of administrative costs. And so I so much appreciate the question because it gives us an opportunity to set the record straight and say that our system office is not growing. Actually, it is going the other way, which we think to be appropriate. Now, let me turn my discussion to what I really came to talk about. I would like to convey the board's commitment to the proposal you will be receiving today. The chancellor's bringing these budget priorities on behalf of the board, which has unanimously endorsed each element of this legislative request. As part of our deliberations, we directed Chancellor Rosenstone, campus presidents, and system leaders to ensure the focal point of our legislative requests, the focal point of their leadership, focus on more than 430,000 students in our colleges and universities serve each year. Our budget proposal reflects that vision. As you will see, our request will enable our colleges and universities to deliver the outcomes Minnesota needs to prosper. The budget we are proposing meets our obligation to address the needs of our students. It will also deliver the outcomes required to keep Minnesota communities economically vibrant and competitive. Importantly, our request fully recognizes the financial constraints facing the state and the needs for Minsky's active participation in addressing the physical challenges we face. With this in mind, our budget proposes a shared funding strategy that does not rely solely on state fundings, but rather on a three-way partnership. That first part of that three-way partnership is that it leverages cost reductions and efficiencies from our campuses. Secondly, it leverages private contributions. And thirdly, it leverages new investments from the state. I'm also here to assure you that we will deliver on our commitment. To repeat what my colleague shared with you on January 27th at the hearing, he shared this. He said that the board is tenacious in our oversight and unyielding in our demand for accountability and results from Chancellor Rosenstone and our campus and system leaders. One of the main reasons that we're confident that we can deliver the outcomes needed for Minnesota to succeed is because of our shared values. People from across Minnesota believe that everyone deserves an opportunity to create a better future, that Minnesota can compete globally, that Minnesota can lead the nation in delivering high-quality, affordable education, that we can and will deliver graduates with both the skills necessary to advance the state's global competitiveness and the aptitude for the lifelong learning that is fundamental to sustain success. These are not just Minsky values. These are Minnesota values shared by people. People that are on both sides of the political aisle. People that are workers and business owners. People that are miners on the range and composite engineers in Winona. People that are farmers in Marshall and manufacturers in St. Cloud. And people that are small business people in Moorhead and Fortune 500 executives in the Twin Cities. These are Minnesota values. We can build upon these shared values to help advance our common interests. In closing, I want to emphasize that Minsky is a tremendous state resource, a resource that needs your support and represents an outstanding investment of state taxpayers' dollars. Our campuses are key to the economic success of Minnesota's regional and local economies. Our colleges and universities offer students from all backgrounds the opportunity to create a better future for themselves and their families. The board clearly understands the critical role that Minsky plays in ensuring Minnesota's prosperity and what our collective success as a state requires. With those comments, Madam Chair, I return now to Chancellor Rosenstone.
Thank you, Chancellor.
Chair Bonhoeff, members of the committee, we left off last time with me sharing with you some of the urgent challenges facing Minnesota. I don't think I need to dwell on this slide again, but these are challenges that I think we in Minnesota State Colleges and Universities have a responsibility to address. And this legislative proposal is designed to address the challenges facing our state. We address those challenges by focusing on the outcomes that we need to produce. And the outcomes on this slide are the outcomes that the initiatives that we'll be discussing this afternoon are aligned with. So it's not just a matter of having academic programs. It's academic programs that are turning out the graduates prepared for the work that needs to be done and to ensure that those academic programs are aligned with the workforce needs of Minnesota and the high demand needs that exist in some sectors. It means protecting access and affordability. It means squarely addressing the need to produce more graduates among low-income and first-generation and communities of color. And it means addressing squarely the need for students to complete their education in a timely and more cost-effective manner. The strategy here is pretty straightforward and simple. First, more students need to be better prepared than ever before to begin post-secondary education, and more people must be on track for a college certificate, diploma, or degree more than ever before. And that includes students from all economic, social, economic, and racial backgrounds. Secondly, we must accelerate completion. More students must finish, and they must finish in a more timely fashion. And finally, it's not just a matter of finishing with a degree or certificate. As I said, it's finishing with a degree or certificate that actually prepares them for the work that needs to be done. And we measure how well we're doing not by the ACT scores of our freshmen, but by the competencies of our graduates. Now, we can get this done, as Chair Hightower suggested, if we work together. And our strategy has been to put the pieces together in far more powerful ways than ever before. Our proposal calls not only upon you and your colleagues in the legislature and the governor to act, but it calls upon us to act, and it calls upon our business partners to act, and it calls upon students and alumni and communities to act in a fashion where together we can get the job done. We must work together to leverage our collective strengths like never before, otherwise we run the risk of failing. Now, to get to the punchline of the request, what it boils down to is that for every dollar we are asking in this proposal, you and the people of Minnesota to provide us through the legislation you're considering, we will provide a dollar-for-dollar match through our efficiencies, through our fundraising, and through the matching grants that we'll discuss with you for the internship program and the leveraged equipment program. We are also asking our students to be at the table with very modest tuition increases, which we'll also discuss, which will be leveraged better than 2-to-1 with the support we're asking you to provide and the support that we will provide through our efficiencies and fundraising. That's the strategy. We are not coming with the request that you write a check and then we go back and do the work. We're coming with a request that we match and do work to help realize the funding necessary to achieve the outcomes we're trying to produce for Minnesota. So the next step is to dive into each of these three legislative priorities. I want to take them up one by one. And give you a sense of what they're designed to do, how they will work, and what funding is necessary to achieve them. The first priority is fundamentally all about jobs. And there are three initiatives here that will improve the competitiveness of Minnesota's workforce and the quality of our graduates. We heard over and over again through our listening sessions across the state. It was there in the Itasca Higher Education Report. We've heard it over and over again from our students that they need hands-on practical experience as part of their education. And internships are the way we can not only provide that hands-on practical experience, real-world experience to our students, but it's a way of preparing students for jobs and careers. It's a way of connecting students to local businesses. It's a way of creating a path for them in their education. And if these are paid internships, it's a way of helping students with the affordability that they confront to cover the costs of their education. It's about affordability and completion. It's not just about job preparation. The paid internship program that we're proposing to you would provide those hands-on learning experiences for students. Our goal is to provide a $1,500 a year internship experience for students for 10,000 students across the state of Minnesota starting in FY15. It would be ramped up gradually over the 2 years of the biennium. We are not asking the state of Minnesota to cover 100% of those costs, but rather we're asking the state of Minnesota to cover half of those costs with a dollar-for-dollar match from the businesses and industries and organizations that will be employing these students as interns. There's an accountability measurement built into this. As we ramp it up, we should be able to demonstrate to you by April of 2014 that we indeed raised at least $3 million of matching funds, and we're saying that accountability metric has to be met before you release the second year of funds for this program. The second initiative here focuses on...
Excuse me, please, Chancellor Rosenstone. Could we talk about each one as we go?
That would be fine. Absolutely.
Thank you. Okay. So with regard to the internships, you mentioned a $1,500 stipend. For how long is that? And does that mean the state does $1,500 and the business does $1,500? So is it really $3,000? Can you give us more detail? And just tell us more, you know, who have you talked to, which businesses, where are these internships?
Chair Bonoff, please do. Good question. Let me clarify. We imagine these to be $1,500 internships in total for roughly one semester of internship, with $750 provided by the state of Minnesota, $750 provided by a match. These internships would be in every college and university across the entire state. This is not a program that will be run out of St. Paul, but rather a program that will be run by each of our colleges and universities. We have tested this idea in conversations around the state since we first started hearing about it in the listening sessions last April. And there's broad support from businesses and manufacturing firms and high-tech firms and biotech firms around the state, as well as the social service sector and the financial service industry, to provide these internships. And at the price that we're talking about, we are quite confident that we'll be able to find the matching funds to match the state's allocation.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chancellor, I would like to encourage you to have a conversation with the different commissioners in the state. About 4 years ago, I was approached by DNR with a request for funding to do a program like this with minority communities, because at the time, the projection was that about 50% of supervisors, program managers, and key individuals in their administration would be leaving the Department of Natural Resources. And they were very alarmed that we were not training people in those careers. And we're talking about jobs that are, you know, $60,000, $75,000. I don't know if DNR has done anything specific, but my understanding is that that is happening across many departments in the state. And, you know, I don't know what we will do with the match, because it's actually, you know, we will have to figure out money. But I understand that these departments already have internship opportunities, and it will be so interesting for us to really figure out how you could connect with the different divisions. We should be able to give you that information, because we do have a problem of not – we don't have trained people to replace the individuals that are in those different departments. So I am very interested in this, and, you know, I think we need to talk about how we can support MNSCU in this process.
Chancellor?
Chair Bonoff, Senator Torres-Reyes, a wonderful idea. I was at Vermilion College just 2 weeks ago, which has one of the four or five programs in the country that trains people both in forestry and law enforcement, so they can play those dual roles. And that would be an ideal place for precisely the kind of partnership that you're suggesting. And I think similar partnerships with other agencies would indeed be a wonderful thing to look at. We've had conversations, for example, with colleagues in Winona exploring whether or not the partnership could be with the public schools for the teaching experience that students get as they're going through their educational program at Winona. And I think that's another place where that would be exactly the kind of match that would make sense through this internship program.
Chancellor, will the students get credit for these internships, and will they pay for their credits?
Chair Barnoff, members of the committee, a good question. We are not going to require that these be for credit because there are some programs where we're already hitting in our colleges the 60-credit limit and our universities the 120-credit limit, and we do not want to break out of that constraint and actually create more work for students. Where students can get credit, we would welcome them getting credit for that, and that would be something that would have to vary program by program. And indeed, they'd use some of the $1,500 to cover the cost of that credit. But requiring that all of these be for credit would actually slow down the pace to completion for some of our students and break out of the 60-120 rule that we're trying to observe.
Are there questions on the internships? One of the things I've observed raising kids in this age range is many of them are willing to do internships for no money because it does set them up for employment. Have you considered that, and what's your thoughts on that?
Well, Chair Barnoff, we're trying to get a triple dip here. One, we're trying to get the experience. Secondly, we're trying to get help from business and industry in funding this. Third, we're trying to address the affordability. And fourth, I guess a quadruple dip, we'd want to facilitate completion. And if we can create this sense of a goal at the end, if we can help on the affordability, it will help on completion. And so it's not just a matter of giving experiences for those that can afford the volunteer experience, because many of our students can't afford to take off the time to do an internship if there's not some pay attached to it.
Right.
And if it's going to be accessible to all students, there have to be some dollars attached to it.
I hear you. Other comments? Okay. Thank you.
Terrific. The second thing that we heard loud and clear from our listening sessions is that we need to make sure that our graduates are being trained on state-of-the-art technology. We had a pilot program as a result of legislative action that was taken in the last session. The legislature appropriated $457,000 for a leveraged equipment program, requiring a dollar-for-dollar match for that equipment. We were able to deploy equipment to 12 colleges and 3 universities as a result of that, but it's now time to scale that up statewide. And one of the places where the budget cuts have been particularly severe over the last 2 biennium has been in the ability of our colleges and universities to have state-of-the-art equipment to train our students. So the leverage equipment program that we imagine would be $21 million of state funding, and again, matched dollar for dollar by funding from industry and from businesses. The accountability here is that we need to demonstrate by April of 2014 that as we've ramped up this program, we've raised at least $7.5 million in matches before you would release to us the second year's dollars in the biennium. This would have a very powerful effect on ensuring that we have students trained for the work that needs to be done on state-of-the-art equipment. And the other kind of built-in accountability here is if there's a dollar-dollar match from business and industry, they're not going to be matching equipment that isn't the right equipment for the workforce that they need for the future.
Senator Wortman.
Thank you. Mr. Chancellor, would a tax credit or deduction help you to maximize those donations? It would seem to me that if the state had a match, but there were also some kind of tax deductibility, our businesses would have an even further incentive to donate equipment when they upgrade or buy a second piece or something like that. Is that something that you've considered?
Chancellor?
Chair Barnoff, Senator Ortman, a great question. I am not an accountant or tax attorney, so I want to hesitate answering that question directly. But I believe if those gifts are made through the foundations associated with one of our colleges or universities, there's probably some tax advantages already available to those organizations. I'm not sure there's a need for additional tax advantages.
Senator Wortman.
Madam Chair and Chancellor, will you check for me? I'd really like to know if we have some kind of
deductibility or tax credit for the donations of that type of equipment.
Senator Bonhoff, Senator Artman, of course.
Thank you.
Be pleased to.
Very good.
Chancellor, do you have some insight as to why the governor proposed to give more than you had asked for in your request with regard to leveraged equipment?
Chair Bonhoff, I do not. He's not communicated with me about his recommendation. There are lots of categories where I'd like him to continue to recommend more than we have asked. But you'd have to ask the governor directly. He's not shared
okay,
that
thank
with
you. Go ahead.
Thank you. The third initiative under this first priority has to do with faculty-driven educational innovations. As I mentioned last year, our faculty considered the question, what does an extraordinary education look like? And our students took on the same question. Simply put, students want innovations in teaching that prepare them for collaborative work in a networked world. And most faculty are very eager to bring new technologies into their courses, but simply put, they need help to do so. They can't do it on top of everything else they're doing. So this investment in educational innovation will involve and enable each college and university to create teams made up of technology professionals and instructional designers who can work directly with faculty to create the best possible online and blended learning experience for our students, courses that will prepare them for the work they'll be doing in the 21st century. Now, we have a couple places around the system where universities and colleges have been able to do this. Metropolitan State University here in the Metro, Winona State University, and only the largest of our colleges, Normandale, Inverhills Community College in particular, have had teams in place to do this, and results have been simply fantastic. We want to scale up those practices so they're available to students and faculty across the entire state. This slide gives just a couple examples of what these innovative practices look like. It allows students to learn seamlessly between the physical and online worlds to solve problems, to learn how to communicate in new ways with teams and with clients, and to use the tools of the internet and mobile communication devices in new and more powerful ways. Put differently, if we want students to be able to master the competencies of their chosen field and easily integrate new technologies, we simply have to support our faculty in being able to deliver those kinds of experiences and learning experiences to our students. So the proposal is a total of $8 million over the 2 years, $4 million in FY14 and $4 million in FY15, to enable colleges and universities to move forward in transforming teaching and learning processes in ways that will benefit all students. This will fund approximately 40 FTE across the system. All these FTE will be on college and university campuses. In some cases, it will allow a reassignment of faculty to do this kind of work full-time. Over the course of the biennium, we'll have a major redesign of 100 of the most largely enrolled classes, high-impact courses in the system. We expect that the instructional design and technology training will support and be delivered to a significant portion of our faculty throughout the system. There's roughly a three-month ramp-up to get this up and running. It'll be up and running by October of 2013. And if you take all three of these initiatives, the consequence of these initiatives, the internship program, the leveraged equipment program, and the faculty innovations, will be to improve the direct employment of our students in the fields that they are trained for in a way that will get a closer alignment between the graduates returning out and the jobs that need to be filled. Chair Bonhoff, are there questions on this particular
initiative? No, we're just looking at the budget. Thank you.
Okay. Shall I move on?
I think so.
Terrific.
And members, actually, I will just make a comment. For those of you who went on the University of Minnesota tour, it seems to me that this is similar type of classroom experience to the example we saw at the university in their new student center.
Yes, I'm familiar with that.
Right. So that's what I'm asking. Am I correct, Chancellor?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
And as you saw, it's more than just a facility. It's
right.
A lot of work to prepare those kinds of courses and support our faculty.
And train your faculty to be able to teach in that fashion.
Exactly.
Right.
You get it.
Okay. Thank you.
The next priority is to increase access and affordability. And the initiatives we want to share with you are designed to do that. It's core to who we are as a system, core to who we're serving. First, we must expand access to high-demand professions. We know from our listening sessions where we have shortages, and we need to grow in a very strategic way courses and programs available in those professions. Our goal is to serve roughly 3,400 more students and produce 600 additional graduates per year by 2018. And as this ramps up from the investment we're asking, by the year 2021, this investment will serve approximately 4,800 additional students, producing about 2,100 additional students per year. The high-demand, high-growth professions around the state, a sampling of which are listed on this page, are what we heard from business and industry through the listening sessions we heard around the state. These are the high-demand areas in Minnesota and in the future. The program that we imagine is a total of a $10 million in investment, $3 million in FY14, and $7 million in 2015 to meet the demands in these high-demand professions. The requested funds will allow us to build new programs and expand existing ones only in the targeted areas. They'll cover initial costs of program development, space to be leased if indeed we need space, equipment, and the initial hiring of faculty as programs are established. These funds will cover roughly 39% of the cost of the new programs. 61% of the cost of the new programs will be paid for by the students enrolling in those programs. The accountability metric here is that 20 new or expanded programs will be enrolling students by the fall of 2014 before any funds for 2015 will be released.
Chancellor, can you talk about the geographic location of the expected new programs?
Those programs will be all over the state of Minnesota. So, for example, if you're in Alexandria, it's in precision manufacturing. If you're in Winona, it's in composite engineering. If you're in the Northwest, it's probably going to be biotech. If you're in the Southwest, it's going to be agribusiness.
So very specific to the geographic assets.
Very specific to the industry demands in that region of the state.
Good. Questions on that, members? Okay.
Second, as we discussed last time, the Board of Trustees, as well as college, university, and system leadership, have been longstandingly committed to protecting access and affordability by controlling costs. Administrative expenses are not rising in Minsky. If anything, they're moving in the right direction, as Chair Hightower shared with you, and as this graph shares kind of a roll-up across the entire system. Our goal is to do better. And over the course of the next biennium, we are committed to $44 million in additional efficiencies. Those efficiencies will come in two ways. First, as was already alluded to by the trustees that you interviewed, we are implementing the complete redesign of business practices system-wide for finance, human resources, financial aid processing, and procurement. And we are committed to using those efficiencies to help cover costs without raising tuition beyond what we're going to be proposing. Second, our academic programs go through a constant program review process with input from business and industry. This ongoing program review process will enable us to continue to close programs that have low demand but high costs, and this will generate a portion of the $44 million of efficiencies that we're committed to generating over the course of the biennium. Those efficiencies are part of the overall financial plan I discussed with you with the pie chart at the beginning of the presentation. We are committed to Minnesota State colleges and universities continuing to be the lowest cost, most cost-effective higher education option in the state of Minnesota. And we'll do that over the course of the next biennium under this proposal by capping tuition increases at our colleges to no more than $145 a year, and at our universities, capping the increases to no more than $205 per year. Now, access and affordability is not only protected through modest tuition increases, but again, going back to our discussion about internships, the $24 million in paid internships that will serve 10,000 students, if you will, is part of the buy-down of that tuition increase. the internal efficiencies as part of holding the increase to 145 and 205. But there's other ways in which we're going to tackle affordability, which I'll turn to in just a moment. We will be embarking on a $20 million scholarship campaign designed to serve 16,000 students. We'll be discussing with you in a moment a change in the state grant program to help working part-time students with financial need. We are committed to helping students graduate in a more timely fashion, and we are interested in working with K-12 to ensure that more students will get access to higher education while they're still in high school to allow them to complete part of their college education before they even graduate high school.
Chancellor Rosenstone, the $145 annual increase, when you say annual, that presupposes this is every year?
Chair Bonhoff, this would be in each of the next 2 years of the biennium.
Okay. So
this is, we're only talking about the biennium ahead of us.
Thank you. Okay. And Senator Miller?
I have a question. Just going back to the internships, you just mentioned 10,000 internships at $1,500 a piece. That's about $15 million, but you're raising 12 from the state, and then a 12 match, that'd be $24 million. Is that right?
Chancellor?
Senator Miller, remember we have to ramp up this program. We can't get them all in place the first year, and this is over a two-year period. So if you take that for the second year, which is the target we're hitting, the remainder will be covered in the first year. This is not a one-shot deal, but it's going to occur over the 2 years of the biennium.
Okay.
Senator Claussen? Oh, no. Chancellor, did you consider not doing the increases at all, given, you know, the current situation with our student debt and using your efficiencies simply to offset the tuition increase entirely? And can you just share your thinking? I know they voted, so you've got student support for this plan, but I'm just wondering if you'd share with the committee your thinking.
Chair Bonhoff, members of the committee, we thought a great deal about this and had extended conversations starting in May of last year. Remember, we never went to the high tuition model. We never went as a public institution to $13,000 of tuition and fees in our universities, but rather we're sitting at closer to $7,300 in tuition and fees. Second, the trade-off is there going to be any investment in new programs to facilitate the work of our students? Do we forego the internship program? Do we forego the leveraged equipment program? Do we forego the investments we want to talk about in a moment to facilitate the completion of our students? All of those items would need to be foregone if our entire request was focusing on making up for the tuition revenue. Remember, to meet the tuition needs of our student over the next 2 years would be 78 of the $80 million the governor has recommended. Instead, we have a shared solution by saying the investment we're asking you to make, in addition to the investment we're making through our efficiencies, is to build the quality of the programs that we're delivering to our students. That's the trade-off, and there's no way we can get the investments in the quality we want to add for our students without the students being part of the solution. And so, yes, we thought very carefully about it.
Senator Sharon.
Are you able to say what that modest tuition increase number creates for you? What the value of that is?
Chancellor.
Chair Bonhoff, Senator Sharon, yes. Over the 2 years of the biennium, the students will be contributing $78 million towards the budget for the next 2 years.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chancellor, do you have an idea of what the increase or decrease will be in room and meals, the other fees that are associated with, in addition to the tuition that students have to pay?
Chancellor.
Chair Bonhoff, Senator Miller, we have in the budget instructions that we have sent to our campuses, have instructed the campuses, the colleges, and universities that those fees should not exceed 3%. And so that will, of course, vary by college or university.
Chancellor Rosenstone,
go ahead. One caveat, unless it is a revenue fund fee, by that I mean if it's a fee to pay for a new parking structure and the students voted for the new parking structure, that may cause their fee to go up a little higher than the 3% we have set.
Okay.
Senator Miller.
And Madam Chair and Chancellor, what is that current? So it would be a 3% increase from, you mentioned the $7,300 is the tuition and fees, and then what is the, and I see Ms. King coming.
This is the lifeline we heard about.
Indeed. If we go back to the chart on the previous page, the numbers here are the average across our colleges and universities for all tuition and fees this year. So it just happens that the 145 and 205 is approximately 3%. And so if we're holding all tuition and fees to a 3% increase, it would be 3% on top of the numbers you see here. So it'd be 3% of 5355 approximately, and 3% of the 7340. It will still keep this remarkably affordable in comparison to the other alternatives in the state.
Chancellor, the 3%, that's tuition plus fees aggregated, is the 3%.
Chair Bonhoff, it would be the figures on this graph include tuition and fees.
Thank you.
So it'd be 3% of the figures on this chart.
And going back to Senator Sharon's question that she asked, I just want to make sure that we got the answer correctly. The $78 million is just with the $145 per student increase and the other?
Chair Bonhoff, it's $145 at our colleges,
right,
and $205 at our universities.
Adding just that up is where you got the
$78. And it's over the 2 years of the biennium.
Thank you. So half 1 year, half the other.
Be clear. It's not half of 145 in year one and the other half in year two.
No, I understood that. I meant the $78 million figure.
No, there's less in the first year and more in the second year because they accumulate. It's biennial math, as
gotcha.
We call it.
Gotcha. Thank you. Clear. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chancellor, just to be clear, so the numbers on this slide, 53, 55 for two-year colleges and $7,340 for four-year, that's tuition and fees but does not include, say, room and board. Is that correct, or is room and board included in these numbers?
Chair Bonhoff, Senator Miller, room and board is not included in these numbers because, as you well know, in many of our colleges in particular, but also many of our university students do not live in dormitories.
Sure. So, Madam Chair,
Senator,
Chancellor, what specifically for the four-year, so for the universities, do we have an idea what those additional costs are on top of the $7,340? Is there an average?
Chancellor.
Chair Bonhoff, Senator Miller, we'd have to get back with you on the details. I believe they vary quite a bit across our campuses. Okay.
Senator Sharon. Oh, I'm sorry. Chancellor.
And we will not know yet what the costs will be for FY14. Those are being worked out as we speak.
Okay.
Senator Sharon.
Just a couple questions. I'm assuming that room and board doesn't exist in any of these four-year institutions in these numbers. So the Minnesota State University, University of Minnesota private colleges, you're not calculating room and board in any of those numbers.
But Chair Bonhoff, Senator Sharon, that is correct.
Chancellor.
Yes. And I just wanted, as you were talking, we were sort of stunned by this number, obviously. Maybe that's, it's an expensive proposition for our students, but I also heard you say that I need to think about that number in relationship. For example, we've heard in the university's presentation that they would hold tuition flat if we created a certain dollar contribution to the university. There was sort of, you could say to us, if you gave us $78 million more dollars, we would be able to meet our objectives and not raise revenue too. But
Chair Bonhoff, Senator Sharon, you're starting to speak like the governor has. and if indeed, in its infinite wisdom, the legislature and the governor wishes to add $78 million to our $97 million request, we could work with you on that.
Yes, I think. But I would,
Senator Sharon.
And my follow-up on that is, but in addition to saying that, which would be, you're also asking us to consider that you're that your $7,340 or $5,350 is a commitment to has been over a long period of time commitment to very low tuition, as opposed to what other costs are for the University of Minnesota, the private colleges and universities. So I'm drawing from that you're suggesting that there's more room when you have to accomplish objectives or keep down tuition when you have larger tuition to start with, like $12,881 or $33,000 as opposed to $7,340. That your efforts to state, sort of like our state gets penalized all the time for its efficiencies. But your long-term goal and commitment as a system to a certain function, to a certain population, and to decisions about sustaining over time, even before you were chancellor, to keep tuition low makes it difficult for you to integrate in a tuition freeze a partial solution even to $78 million. Is that my understanding of your comment?
Chair Bonhoff, Senator Sharon, these are among the most difficult questions I've had to wrestle with, to be quite honest. The trade-off is this. We've heard loud and clear from the people of Minnesota what they want us to do to help Minnesota be prosperous. We've heard about the kind of training they want our students to have. We've heard about the kind of equipment they want them trained on. We heard about the kind of experience they want. We discussed at our last meeting, and it is a priority, that we do better on completion and retention than ever before, and we know how to do it, and it's going to cost some money to get that done. And the question is, do we forego that investment and not deliver on those innovations, and innovations in the way our faculty teach, or do we forego compensation for 4 more years for our faculty? Because there's also funds required to cover that compensation. Do we forego all that in order to hold tuition flat? And that was the debate we had to have. And I will tell you that the way we came out was very simple. If we are not in a position to have a competitive faculty because there's no more compensation for the next 4 years, if we're not in a position to upgrade our facilities and have the technology we need and to provide the experience for our students and to do better, as you're going to ask us to do, on completion and have the tools to do that, then it's kind of a false promise to hold tuition flat but not have a quality of experience worthy of students coming to our colleges and universities. And that's the trade-off that we've been wrestling with. And so the way we decided that question in consultation with our students was to try to get a balance here of some of the weight being carried by our students in exchange for these innovations that will protect and advance the quality of the experience that we're giving them and their preparation for work. And that was the difficult thing we had to weigh. So we were not prepared to forego the innovations we need to make, the quality of the experience, 4 more years of pay increases for our faculty, and turning out more competitive graduates in exchange for no increase in tuition. Everybody's contributing something to the solution. Our students, the efficiency, business and industry, communities, alumni through the scholarship campaign, everybody's contributing something to the solution. We're not saying everything can be paid for by the state of Minnesota. That's the trade-off we balanced here.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I appreciate what you're saying. I'm just trying to wrestle in my mind with a conclusion I'm coming to that might not be valid, and that is that the long-term vision for the Minsku system in terms of having a less costly but affordable resource to persons who might not be able to have access to the University of Minnesota or other private colleges, a lot of part-time students. So when you talk about this goal that you have about early graduation, I get anxious about that in relationship to whom you're serving,
yes,
which is a part-time student, and a measure on that. So, but setting that aside, the assumption that I'm coming to based on what you're saying is that we're coming to a confrontation with a goal that we've had to keep the cost of this education low, and the consequence of that has been that we have not the product that we need in order to have the educated workforce we need in the public. We're getting people graduated, but not necessarily getting the breadth or the depth of education that's going to be needed for the future. And so we're sort of coming to a place where we have to confront that. We've been efficient, we've been tight, we've been inexpensive, but we can't continue to do that. And you're so tight in what you're charging that there's not a lot of room within that current budget to be able to achieve these objectives and sort of take that in and swallow it in a way that you could avoid tuition increases. That's what I'm integrating from what you're saying to me.
Senator Bonhoff, yes, Senator Sharon, beautifully spoken, mm-hmm. and that is indeed the conundrum we're facing. First of all, there's going to be no backing off on this commitment to access and affordability. If we do not continue with that commitment and make good on that commitment, all the people that need to be served in Minnesota, that need to be prepared for the work that needs to be done, from all the new communities that need to be part of higher education, will not be served if we don't do it. Secondly, we've just absorbed over the last two biennium $212 million in state cuts. Our faculty are celebrating, and I use that word ironically, their fourth year of no pay increases. We don't have the equipment we need to generate the education that students need to be prepared, and they don't have the experience they need, and we don't have the technology in the classroom. The list goes on and on. And so, again, it's this balance between how we have the resource we need to deliver precisely the kind of education Minnesota expects us to deliver, our students and communities expect, and by the way, if we don't deliver it, Minnesota's going to be in trouble. It's balancing that versus the resources that we all got to bring together to get this to work. And so that indeed is the conundrum, and we are committed both to affordability and excellence. And how it is you figure that out year to year and get the right balance so that you're not doing damage to either is precisely what we're wrestling with in this budget proposal. And in our judgment, it was a little help from everybody in order to make the investments to improve the quality without doing the damage to the affordability. But the long-term commitment both to the excellence and the affordability is a commitment of this system. One final point, the $205. It's an internship program that's going to help buy it down, which we've talked about. It's a $20 million scholarship campaign that's going to provide scholarships to students that we're going to engage in with our foundations to help buy it down. We're going to talk in just a moment about bringing into the state grant program working part-time students that the formula currently excludes from the state grant. That's designed to buy it down. And if we can move students through our system faster by speeding up completion, that will help buy down the cost of tuition as well to protect affordability and also hit the completion goals that we want to be able to meet as well. So the chart on the page is historically since 2005. The position that the board has had, where despite the modest tuition increases, they have been able to hold tuition as a percentage of median family income fairly constant over the last several years. And this tuition increase will continue that flat trend at both our colleges and universities to protect affordability relative to what income is in the state of Minnesota.
Senator Miller had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just on this point, and we keep coming back to the modest tuition increases, but that's where I think the other part is important, and that's why I'd like to see it not only for...
We have the information for us, Senator Miller.
Oh, the room and board. And,
yep.
Okay.
Ms. Weidman, you want to add
Madam
that?
Madam Chair, Senator Miller, across all the state university systems, the average room and board for a double room is $6,725.
Okay, so that $6,025 is added on top of the tuition. Mm-hmm. So I just think that's important for members of the committee to know that it's not just the $7,300, it's the $7,300 plus the 60 whatever. And then I'd also like to know from Minsky how much that number's increased, say, over the last 10 years, because those are real costs to our students that are important in the conversation of tuition as well.
Chancellor.
Chair Bonhoff, Senator Miller, be pleased to prepare and share that information with the committee. Realize, of course, that the reason for the tuition increases, the lion's share of the reason for the tuition increases over the last decade, have been a response to the withdrawal of state support. And the amount of the cuts that we have had to make in the reallocation is a larger share of the way we've solved the budget problems than with tuition. And so again, we've faced that conundrum over the past decade of how it is we try to protect quality and indeed advance quality in the face of diminishing resources. So we have not raised tuition because we could, because we like to, because it can get paid for. We've raised it to try to balance the cuts that have occurred from the state of Minnesota and to protect the quality we need to. But realize also that the way in which we've dealt with $212 million of cuts over the last 2 years is not just by raising tuition. It's by making massive cuts in programs, massing cuts in investment, and by faculty and many staff groups foregoing pay increases for 4 years to help solve this problem. That is not a sustainable future for excellence in higher education and for meeting the workforce needs of Minnesota.
Chancellor, where does the new conversation about, you know, we're going to be as a committee hearing from a woman on MOOCs next Tuesday, and where does that conversation fit in with the whole bricks and mortar expense structure, and what might we see you doing in the future?
Chair Bonhoff, wonderful question.
And then Senator Aiken, I know you have a question too.
Wonderful question, and I think as Trustee Cirillo and Erlinson alluded to, I have appointed last fall three working groups comprised of students, faculty, staff, presidents, and members of our board to focus on three large questions. What does the education of the future look like, and what strategically should we be doing in MinSCU to provide that education in new ways? Secondly, how do we provide the workforce of the future, and what changes do we make in MinSCU to respond to that? And third, what does the system MinSCU look like 5 years from now? How does it get redesigned and reorganized in light, in part, of the first two questions? Those work groups are up and running. They will be providing preliminary recommendations in June. We'll have a four-month period for public conversation, debate, discussion of those recommendations. They'll be codified early fall, and that will be the work plan moving forward. So we're addressing all those questions very aggressively.
Senator Aiken.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Rosenstone. I was looking at the breakdown here of the overall request and the efficiencies and external support, the 35.5%. I was wondering about the external support, exactly where that would be coming from. I guess one of the concerns I have is if this is a projection that's a, you know, firm projection, or if this is more of an estimate of what you expect to be acquiring in the future. And the same thing with, I know the efficiencies, you listed $44 million with the efficiencies that you're looking to gain. I guess my concern is that if the funding doesn't come through that you're expecting, that it could result in cuts in offerings and things like that, which make it harder for students to graduate on time or get the classes they need when they need them. So I was just wondering if you could drill down a little more on the external support in particular.
Chancellor Rosenstein.
Chair Bonhoff, Senator Aiken, please too. The external support comes in three pieces: the matching to the internship program, the matches for leveraged equipment, and the scholarship that we're going to raise. We can raise $22 million over the next 2 years. With respect to the internship program and the leveraged equipment, we want to build in as part of the legislation an accountability metric that if we don't hit certain benchmarks, you will not give us money for the second year of the biennium for those initiatives. With respect to the internal efficiency, it's going to come in two pieces. The shared service initiative, which the trustees have alluded to and that we talked a bit about at our last session together, we've done a pretty rigorous pro forma with the help of IBM Consulting to identify that we should be able, over the next 2 years of the biennium, save $36 million through the redesign of our procurement, financial aid processing, business practices, and HR processes. They're very confident of that projection. I am confident of that projection. The other $8 million will come from the general process by which we review programs and make adjustments and do the work we do all the time, which is identify places where we can make cuts and redeploy those resources. Those $44 million I think you can count on. And we can have discussions over the course of the next couple years, so you'd have check-ins with us that we can demonstrate in a very transparent way that we've delivered on that.
Thank you.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chancellor, you've emphasized in your conversation today about the reductions that you've made to extend the state's reductions in its share of funding. And I thought you said $212 million. Is that the number? Can you tell me over what period of time you're measuring those $212 million in reductions from the state?
Chancellor. Chair Bonhoff, that's the last two biennium.
The last two bienniums?
Yes.
And Madam
so
Chair.
It's, excuse me, to clarify, it's FY13, FY12, FY11, FY10.
All right, and thank you. And Madam Chair and Chancellor, over that same period of time, you've had some tuition adjustments. Can you tell me how much money you raised in over that same period of time in tuition adjustments?
Chancellor.
Chair Bonhoff, Senator Ortman, it's a little more complicated than that because we've also had increases in the costs of utilities. We've had increases in the cost of insurance. We've had increases in the cost of health care for our faculty. We had some contractual obligations that need to be paid for. So the way we need to think about it is, what's the total challenge? The challenge are those things that we have to pay for, whether we like it or not, that are going up, as well as the cuts from the state of Minnesota. And the strategy for dealing with that challenge is twofold. One, where we're making cuts and how much we're asking our students to pay. I think the exact number is somewhere around 40% covered by our students, 60% covered by us. Do we have that exact number? That's the pie chart.
I don't have the pie chart.
We'll get that number for you. I looked at a pie chart on this morning. But the point that needs to be made is that the lion's share of this was not covered by tuition. It was covered by the hard work we did and that our faculty and staff did in foregoing salary increases.
Senator Ortman?
Madam Chair and Chancellor, I want to praise your efforts. I want to know, though, and I don't think that I need the analysis of what other costs you had in order to understand if you've done a good job. I believe you do an excellent job, but I would like to know how much you raised in tuition. If there is other information that would help me to understand that better, please give me that too. But I think a straightforward answer, if you can measure the reductions by the $212 million over a four-year period of time, I think you can also measure how much the tuition increase is brought in terms of revenue. And I would appreciate just a straight answer.
Chair Bonhoff would be pleased to share that information with the committee. Absolutely pleased.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, Chancellor.
Terrific. Let's see if we can get back on track. I know our time is short.
This is on track. This is good.
This is good.
That's right, because this committee is going to have to agree on a budget for the biennium, and it's not going to be easy as we look at resources for us to come to consensus. So the more trouble and, you know, tension we go through in this process, the easier it's going to become that process.
Chair Bonhoff, I don't regard this either as trouble or tension.
These are great questions.
I just want to be cognizant of our time.
Thank you.
I mentioned the scholarship campaign. I don't think I need to dwell on that more, but we will raise $20 million over the next 2 years, which will be available to our students. The next issue I do want to touch on is the state grant program. I think time has finally come to address the bias against part-time working students in the state grant program's formulas. Our board is asking that the funding formula change to open the benefits of this program to the more than 9,900 part-time working students with financial needs across the state who are currently excluded from participating in the state grant program. This proposal will help all part-time working students with financial need, whether they are in a Minsky college or university or any other college or university in the state of Minnesota. We cannot provide access to higher education or provide the workforce that Minnesota needs if working students with financial need who out of necessity attend part-time cannot get help from the state grant program. This change in the state grant program will help ensure success for students traditionally underserved by higher education and will help students get to the finish line in a more timely fashion. So, Madam Chair, the best way to understand the current problem with the state grant program formula is to hear firsthand from students who've lived through the problem. And with your permission, I'd like to invite Matthew Rubel, a student from North Hennepin Community College, who will briefly share with you his experience, and Chris Halling, the system's director for financial aid.
Very good. Mr. Rubel and Mr. Halling, I'm going to join
your colleagues at the table. So it looks like Mr. Rubel first. Introduce yourself for the record. Oh, the other way around?
I think the other way around, if that's
okay. Okay, very good.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Halling. I am the System Director for Student Financial Aid. Quickly, by way of background, I have been in this position for 15 years. Prior to that, mm-hmm. I was the Director of Student Financial Aid for 7 years at the University of St. Thomas. And for 7 years, I was the Associate Director and Director over the Office for Student Financial Aid at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, and also spent 3 years working on the student loan side of the business, working with primarily with law schools and graduate business schools. Excuse me. So that's my background. We've prepared a couple of examples to try to illustrate for you just exactly what the inequity is that the Chancellor mentioned. I should start by saying that we're talking about a specific group of students. These are part-time students, but they're part-time students who work. And they work enough so that they can contribute something toward meeting the cost of their education. When you heard the Office of Higher Education presentation a couple of weeks ago, they walked you through the state grant formula. One of the things they talked about was the Assigned Family Responsibility, or AFR. That's a number I'll be mentioning a few times, and that basically is the amount that the state believes a student can contribute out of their income. That's the group that we're talking about. Students who are attending part-time, primarily because they're working in order to help pay for their education. What we're talking about is an issue that it affects these students because the state does not prorate their combined Pell and State grant to their level of enrollment. And just looking at this first example to try to illustrate that, this is a case of a single independent student who's attending a state university. In this case, I chose Winona State University. And I made these examples using the Office of Higher Education's financial aid estimator tool, so plugging in information about a student produced these results. The state considers that 15 credits is full-time enrollment for the state grant program. In this case, you'll see if you look in the lower left corner, the student's working 30 hours a week. They have an income of $26,000. The state calculates that their ability to pay is $4,000. That's their AFR. Because of that, because they're working 30 hours a week, they're not able to attend full-time. They're enrolled for 9 credits, which is 60% of full-time. They do not receive 60% of a full-time state grant. If you look at the center column, the way things are right now, they receive a prorated Pell Grant because the federal Pell Grant does prorate their awards. They don't receive any state grant because of the reduction of 6 credits. They don't receive anything, which means the total of what they're receiving in the Pell and State Grant is 22% of what their full-time award would have been. What we're suggesting is a simple solution that would restore that ratio so that for that student, they would receive a combined Pell and State Grant that would be 60% of what their full-time award would have been. Does that make sense so far? We have another example that I wanted to show you because I want to make it clear that this applies to part-time students across the state, whether they're dependent or independent, whether they're single or married, whether they have children or not. If they're attending part-time because they're working, this particular problem applies to them. In this case, it's a married independent student attending one of our two-year colleges. With one child, the student's working half-time, the spouse is working full-time, the income is $42,000. The state determines that that student can contribute $1,000 toward the cost of their education. They're attending for 8 credits a term, which is 53% of what their full-time enrollment would be, but they're only receiving 45% of what their full-time award would be. They're getting a prorated Pell Grant, but they're not getting a fully prorated state grant. If they were, you can see on the right-hand column, they would be getting 53% of their full-time grant, or $919 in state grant as opposed to $452, an increase of $467. The third example, I wanted to make clear, this does apply to dependent students as well, but in this case, it's a student who's attending North Hennepin Community College living with their parents. Parents are working, and the family income is $48,000. The student herself is working 20 hours a week and contributing to that. The state determines that the family as a whole is able to contribute $3,000. The student is making what might be a heroic effort here and attending 11 credits a term, which is 73% of full time. They're only receiving 53% of their full-time award under the current calculation. They're getting a prorated Pell Grant. They're not getting a prorated state grant.
In this case, Mr. Hung, why are they getting given they're a dependent student, what is it about the formula that gives them this small amount of the state grant?
That's a very good question. And the reason is that the formula treats them the same whether they are working on their own as an independent student to provide enough money to pay for some of their education, or whether they're living with their parents and their parents are providing some of the education. If they're going part-time, this is what happens. Whether the contribution, whether the assigned family responsibility is coming from them or their spouse or their parents, the treatment is the same.
Mr. Hong, I was under the impression that our dependent students didn't have anything taken away from their grant potential for the work they were doing.
That is correct.
Okay.
And in this case, the student is working 20 hours per week, and it may very well be that they're using that to pay the student share, which you heard about in the presentation from the Office of Higher Education. That's currently 46% of all their expenses. Mm-hmm. They may be contributing toward the family income as well, the family's expenses. But you are correct. In this case, it's the parents who are contributing the $3,000. And because the student's attending part-time, that contribution is treated the same way as it is in the other examples.
Okay.
If the grant were prorated, you can see that we would restore the state grant to 70 and the Pell Grant combined to 73% of what the full-time grant would have been.
And have you presented your proposal to the Office of Higher Ed?
The proposal has been raised many times over the years informally by members of the Minnesota Association of Financial Aid Administrators, the statewide professional association, which includes members from the public and private schools all across the state. So the issue has been raised in the past.
Mr. Hine, I just raised that with you now because we're working pretty hard with that group to try and deal with the inequities that students have brought to us. So I would just encourage you to be in full communication so that as they're getting direction and requests from our office and from other members, that they're hearing your proposed solutions.
That's an excellent suggestion. I can tell you that I am in weekly, if not daily, communication with members of the staff there throughout most of the year.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Hauling, do you guys have a formal proposal that you could share with us? I mean, I understand the examples, but is there a formal written proposal that we could take?
Our suggestion Mr. would Hauling. Be that a small change in the formula would be made. And the change would be this. We would direct that the student's AFR, that contribution, simply be prorated to the level of enrollment. That's what happens with the Pell Grant. That's what happens right now for students who are part-time but aren't working effectively. And that will produce this outcome.
Very good.
Thank you.
Yeah, and also, Mr. Hauling, it seems to me that we're all suggesting that students who are independent with children shouldn't be penalized.
Oh, no, absolutely not. They're all in the same boat if they're
right.
part-time. They're all being treated the same. We would like the solution to apply to all students in that,
we
in
agree.
That situation.
We agree. Thank you. Yes, Senator Aiken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Hauling, I like the proposal that you're talking about here. I do think there needs to be some equity brought to the part-time student. I did want to bring up one concern that was raised about not encouraging part-time student as opposed to going full-time because part-time students tend not to graduate as high levels as those that go full-time. I just wanted to know if I could get your response to that. If there's I know that was one concern that was raised. I do, however, sympathize with what's happening here because there are more students going part-time now than ever before, not because they choose to, but because they oftentimes have to because of the work that they're doing and they're working their way through. So I understand that, but I just thought I'd get your response, if I could, to the
Madam Chair,
do you have figures or anything dealing with that?
And, Senator, that's absolutely right. And this feature of the state grant formula has been in place since the mid-'80s. And the world has changed a lot since then. And as you said, we have an ever-increasing population of students who are part-time because where they are in life almost demands that they do that. And that's the student that I'm talking about here. I'm talking about a student who is attending part-time because maybe they're older. They may have a family. They're working in all these cases because if they're not working, they don't have this problem. So, yes, absolutely. And I don't think that this is a proposal that would encourage students to take longer to get through school. It's a proposal that would, in fact, provide them enough extra state grant. If we restore it to, if we put it at that prorated level, they might perhaps be able to complete more quickly because they would have a little bit more help to pay tuition. Okay.
Senator Bonhoff, with your permission.
Chancellor.
Senator Bonhoff, Senator Aiken. I've had conversations with academic advisors who are alarmed at the number of students that try to go full-time to qualify for the grant that are setting themselves up for failure. And we actually have some research that's been done at MCTC, which has questioned precisely the point that you've raised. And what they've discovered is that if they can identify students who are at risk when they join the college and get them to be not going full-time, to be going 9 to 11 credits, they turn out to be far more successful than students who are at risk who go full-time. And so much of the evidence that the kind of the urban lore about this slowing down attrition is evidence that comes from Michigan and Penn State and University of Pennsylvania and elite institutions where that might indeed be the case, but not with the populations we're serving. If you stay tuned for just a moment when we get to the completion conversation, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. So I agree with Mr. Hollings. For our students, this is going to open the doors of access, help them be successful, and help them complete in a way rather than slowing them down.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, based on one of the charts we received last week from the Student Association, there's actually, the way the grant program is set up now, there might be an incentive for students to take one or two credits less or one or two credits more based on the current formula. So I think a formula that you're proposing is much better and doesn't encourage those students to take one or two less. If that chart is assuming the chart is accurate that we received last week from the Student Association.
Madam Chair, could I ask Matthew Rubel to say a few words?
Very good, Mr. Rubel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matt Rubel. I'm a part-time student at North Hennepin Community College in the paralegal program. The cost of college definitely had an impact on my decision to go to college. Following high school graduation, I was intimidated by the price of tuition, so I chose to enter the workforce. I began working at both UPS and Jimmy John's. A few years in these positions, I realized without higher education, I faced a future of dismal employment prospects. I have been a student since 2009, and attend class on a part-time basis so I can work two jobs to help pay for my education. When I first enrolled at North Hennepin Community College, I was offered tuition reimbursement up to $1,500 a semester through my work at UPS, which I used for two academic years. This allowed me to take approximately 9 credits a semester. Currently, I am fortunate to be employed at a law firm and as a tutor in the paralegal lab at North Hennepin. I began working as an intern at the law firm and was able to use my experience to secure my position there. After completing my paralegal degree, I hope to transfer to a university to earn my bachelor's degree and hope to attend law school to become an attorney. While I have stayed in school for a longer period of time due to attending class part-time, I have done everything possible to save money and prevent myself from taking on student debt. I wanted to take additional credits this semester to increase my state grant award, but that option was simply not possible because of my work schedule. I am going part-time because it was the most financially responsible way for me to attend college. This has allowed me to support myself and begin working in my desired career field. With over half of Minsky College students attending part-time, the change Mr. Holling discussed will impact so many of Minnesota's working students. With the state's critical workforce challenges, we cannot afford to leave any student behind. College affordability should not be an obstacle that stops a student from being able to pursue a higher education. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to address you today, and I will stand for any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Rubel, what is your debt?
At this point, with the tuition reimbursement I was offered previously, I do not have any student debt at this point.
Well, congratulations. You've done a wonderful job.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Isn't that wonderful? Any other questions from the members? Thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Best of luck to you.
Madam Chair, I want to turn to a topic I know that is near and dear to your heart, and that is to accelerate completion. It's an important priority. It's one of the three priorities that we're bringing forward in our legislative request this year. There's a set of strategies that we are prepared to employ that will get the job done. First of all, we know how to get the job done. The book written on completion is a book entitled Crossing the Finish Line. It is 389 pages long, and I'm going to save you 389 pages by giving you the punchline. The two biggest drivers of completion are unmet financial need and academic preparedness. The larger the academic preparedness, the higher the academic preparedness, the sooner you complete, and the higher the probability you complete, and the more unmet financial need, the lower the probability you complete and the longer it's going to take. So this is how it works. These are actual numbers for Minnesota State colleges and universities. If we look at our most highly prepared students at our universities and those with the lowest financial need, they complete their university degree, 61% complete within 4 years. The problem is this. Only 1% of our university students fit in that cell. Now, if we were a different kind of institution, we might have 60 or 70% of our students in that cell, and we might have students that are still even more prepared than the average ACT score of 26, which is this column. At those colleges, universities where the average ACT score might be 27, 28, 29, or 30, that number 61 will continue to grow. So the problem for us is that if we had all of our students sitting in that cell, or even better prepared or lower financial need, we'd have graduation rates which would make you excited as opposed to concerned. Here's the distribution for Minsky students. Most of our students are sitting in one of the other cells. So as financial need gets unmet, the timeliness of graduation declines. As the academic preparedness of students declines, the likelihood of graduating in 6 years also declines. So there's three strategies we need to think about. One is the affordability strategy that we've been talking about, and that's why it's so core to what we're doing, and that's why the discussion we just had about financial aid for part-time students being properly prorated is so crucial to meeting the financial challenges that our students confront. But we also have to worry about how it is we have more of our students better prepared, because that's a huge driver in their ability to make it to the finish line in a timely fashion. So there's two ways we could go about doing that. One, of course, is to exclude those students in the first two columns. That's not our strategy. That's not our responsibility to the people of Minnesota. And indeed, the people that need to be prepared for work happen to also be in the first two columns. So we're not taking that strategy. But one way we can take that strategy is something we talked about last time, which I'll alert you to in just a moment, and that is to work with K-12 so that indeed more students are better prepared for higher education. The strategy we also want to take is to work diligently in each of these cells. And here we also know how to do it. And we have examples already in place across the system where we can employ the analytical techniques to look, as I alluded to the MCTC example, to students who are at risk, put the red flags on when those students are at risk, and have our faculty and staff in place to intervene to help them get back on track. We have examples from across the system where those interventions are working successfully. There's a couple here on this page that I won't have time to go over with you. But there's one in particular where we have someone here who can talk about it, Adam Klepetar from St. Cloud State University is here, and also Courtney Brown, who recently graduated from Metropolitan State University, are here, who can talk about the strategy for completion that exists, the techniques that are in place, and how it interacts with our students. And so with your permission, Madam Chair, I'd like to invite them to the podium.
Thank you. Who's first?
I'll go first.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good evening. For the record, my name is Courtney Brown. I am a graduate of Metropolitan State University's Law Enforcement Bachelor's Program, and I am currently serving as a Dakota County Correctional Deputy. Thank you for this opportunity to briefly describe my journey through higher education and my perspective on college completion for part-time and older than average students. I began my college studies in 1988 in the state of Missouri. At that time, I was interested in studying hotel restaurant management, and I attended college full-time. Over the next 2 years, I attended two additional colleges, earning about 93 credits. I moved back to Minnesota, where my career goals found a new and different focus. I was attracted to Metropolitan State because it was structured to accommodate non-traditional student circumstances. I first enrolled at Metropolitan State in 2009. I was admitted into the law enforcement program, and I was very pleased with the quality of teaching from full-time professors and practitioner scholars. While I now had a career focused with a solid path forward, I was also working about 50 hours a week, coaching my son's basketball team, completing an internship, along with family responsibilities. For me to attend the university full-time would have been a luxury, but it would have meant taking out large private loans. And I would have graduated with another mortgage for my anticipated income that would not have been a responsible financial plan. For me, attending full-time would have meant failure. Attending part-time meant success. While I was taking classes part-time, I was moving full speed ahead on my career and life plans. Now I am able to focus on my first stage of my career journey. I am not encumbered by the kind of debt many college graduates carry. While my total college career over two decades is longer than average, it is not unique. Judging from my many fellow students I met, my circumstances are very common among older than average students. There are many students whose circumstances do not include a four-year college timeline for all kinds of reasons. But if they can find ways to finish their academic business, they can make quality contributions to Minnesota's workforce. I was fortunate to find a university that did not tell me that if I did not attend full-time, my dream was over. From my perspective, I succeeded. Metropolitan State succeeded, and the Minsku system succeeded. 30 graduates of the program are police chiefs, sheriffs, Twin Cities in the Twin Cities region, and they have succeeded while working full-time as peace officers. In closing, I'm very grateful to the people of Minnesota to have access to an outstanding publicly supported program in law enforcement, and I'm excited about the professional career that is ahead of me. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity, and thank you for supporting multiple routes to degree completion for a 21st century workforce.
Congratulations on your accomplishments.
Thank you.
And do you have debt, Mr. Brown?
I do. Madam Chair, I had to take out about $10,000 to $12,000 to complete my skills and what the state grants and Pell grants didn't cover.
Yet you have now you're in a job where I'm sure you see that amount of debt would be manageable given your employment.
Correct.
Yeah, that's wonderful. The right balance. Thanks very much. Other questions? Yep. Senator Ortman.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I think what you just said is exactly why I am such a big fan of Minsku, that there are options and alternatives, and there's a variety of ways that students can get reengaged in education. And I'm very interested if you could comment just a little bit about, and I don't want to go too deep into it, but what maybe didn't go right in your previous college experience that maybe brought you back, and was there you know, some concern about, and trepidation about starting education again? It seems to me that the Minsky system really encouraged you to come back, and I'm very interested in that part. How did you get back into the system, and what maybe went wrong before and what went right this time?
Madam Chair.
Senator. Thanks, Mr. Brown.
I started out as a traditional student, and I transferred from a couple different schools, and then I had the opportunity to try out for the Harlem Globetrotters. I took that opportunity. I traveled abroad. I experienced things I would have never experienced in my life. That's what slowed down my traditional track from graduating.
Aren't you glad you asked?
History of success there.
My situation is probably different than most other students. So.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Well, that's very exciting. Congratulations.
And to answer your second part of your question, I knew that I wanted to finish my degree. I had to. And with my career change, I just had to jump back into it, and that's when I found Metropolitan State, which geared toward working parents, families, and students.
Thank you. Senator Sharon.
And then when you did come back in, were the earlier credits or the earlier efforts you made transferable for you? Were they a part of your next series of efforts towards a degree?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Brown.
Senator. That was the other problem. A lot of the credits did not transfer, so that made my track, my completion, a little bit longer than it normally would have because a lot didn't transfer from the other schools.
Is that because they didn't meet criteria, or was it because they were too old for you to be able to bring them forward? What was the prohibition there?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Brown.
Senator. It was a little bit of both. They didn't meet the criteria, and because of the career change and the major change.
Thank you. I know that this is another goal that everybody's working on, is transferability and improving that outcome as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, yes. And I think we're going to end up right on time, so we're good.
I'll try to go fast, Madam Chair.
You get to take your time.
Madam Chair, I have two daughters in Montessori school, so your comments earlier.
Not yet ready, Mr. Klebitar.
Committee members, my name is Adam Klebitar, and I represent over 700 Minnesota State University Association of Administrative and Service Faculty, or simply ASF. I'd like to begin by thanking Chancellor Rosenstone and this committee for its focus on completion. That's the work that me and the members that I represent do every day. The folks I represent are working to help students succeed in and through college every day. I appreciate having this opportunity to share some of the important work that our administrative faculty do, working one-on-one with students. Our members work to facilitate student learning both inside but actually more often outside of the traditional university classroom, and we all work on university campuses. We work with students from recruitment to graduation. We help them with financial aid, advise them academically, and through hundreds of student organizations. We live with them in the residence halls, keep them safe through campus security, plan service opportunities in our communities, celebrate successes, and listen to tearful eyes when things have gone wrong. In my role as Director of First Year in Transition Programs at St. Cloud State University, I've had the opportunity to coordinate our program for the most academically at-risk students since 2008. In this time, I've seen SDSU students who some would have turned away graduate in 2.5 years, become our student government president, win large scholarships in STEM fields, and persist at higher rates in their first year to second year than general population students. And many of them often earn higher GPAs than their counterparts. At SDSU, we are working to revolutionize the way that we approach student success. We have begun creating predictive analytic models that help us understand which of our students are most at risk to end up on academic warning or probation, to fail to persist into their second year, and to struggle to complete a degree. We have recently reorganized our efforts into a new program called the Academic Collegiate Excellence Program. Students who don't meet our traditional admissions criteria are admitted through this program into SDSU, and we use both quantitative and qualitative information to decide who will most benefit from different intervention strategies that we have for students. Based on this information, we can individualize our strategies for students and best ensure that they have an opportunity to complete a degree. I've had the opportunity to work with thousands of students at my time at SDSU that have come through the door in this matter. As I was preparing these comments, one student really jumped out at me. She took time off between high school and college to just, as she's put it, bum around Germany for a couple of years and work. Her profile would not, it barely got her into through the door. She had about a 2.01 high school GPA, an ACT score below 20. In her first semester at SDSU, she obtained a 3.49, and she worked through a volunteer program that we had, serving as a big sister in a local school. In the subsequent years, she has maintained a relationship to her little, started a student organization based in community service, and will graduate this May. She's been accepted to graduate this May. And hers is one of countless examples of success stories of students that I've personally worked with and my colleagues have worked with throughout the system. And these are our students. As Chancellor Rosenstone stated, we would do better in terms of graduation and persistence if we only brought in students who had 3.5s, 3.8s with very high ACT scores, but that's not who MinSCU serves. It is the mission of all of our MinSCU universities to serve Minnesota students, and part of that mission is to provide access to excellent university life to anyone who legitimately has the skills to be successful. Our students are not going to be to drastically change, but to reach our goals and our work needs to. The funding that the Board of Trustees is requesting will enable students to succeed at all MinSCU colleges and universities. Our common goal is to educate Minnesotans so that they can live and work enriched and productive lives. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you, and I'm happy to stand for questions.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, this is my favorite thing about what you do. And I hope you never lower the standards for those folks in that bottom left corner. I want for every Minnesotan to feel like they have every opportunity to go to college, even if they've washed out once or twice before or they didn't meet somebody's test in life or... I think that's what we do best. It's very exciting, and that opportunity means a lot. And I know that completion rates are important, but I don't want to lose that part of what we do, which is to accept as many people as possible and give them yet another chance, whether it's a third chance or a first chance or a fourth chance. I think that's just the most exciting thing you do. Congratulations to you.
Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Gentlemen, just a quick question. One of the things I like about MinSCU is the diversity of opportunities that you provide, from university setting down to technical college, community college. When I look at the completion rates, I guess I'm wondering, either from the faculty or the administrative standpoint, part of what's causing that completion rate is also maybe not the right fit. And so can you talk about how you coach students through the entire system so that they find the right fit within your offerings?
Chancellor?
Chair Bonhoff, Senator Pratt, great question, and it may actually be the segue to the last point I want to make before we reach adjournment. So if I could just hold that question for a second, I promise you I'll get back to it.
And Chancellor, in your last point, are you going to tell us how you're spending the money you asked for in this area?
Yes, I am indeed.
Thank you.
We're on the same track.
Good. Thank you. You can stay there. We may have questions.
Our goal, Senator, is to do substantially better. And we've projected here what we will be able to do over the next set of years. You need to understand that many of the factors that will affect what these numbers will look like 1, 2, and 3 years from now were factors that were decided 2 and 3 years ago. So we need to be thinking about where we're going and make sure we're on the right trajectory to get there. The dollars we're asking for will do two things. Number one, take the predictive analytics, an example of which you heard from St. Cloud, and make that capacity available on every one of our college and university campuses. There's technology and programming that needs to be installed for that to happen. Secondly, when we discover that a student's at risk, we want to have the advising and faculty time to intervene with that student, whether it's tutoring, coaching, advising,
to make sure that that student gets back on track. We have the pilots from across the system already to demonstrate what those best practices are. With your help, we'll be able to scale them up and deliver the progress you want to see in our completion rates. The very last point, because I know time is of an essence. We spoke very briefly last time, and we've talked with Senator Torres' committee about the alignment of higher education and high school. It needs to change. The two points that are crucial to our conversation today are, if we can have more students better prepared for higher education, then we're moving more students from the left-hand side of that table to the right-hand side of the table, and it'll have a dramatic impact on completion. It'll affect the affordability because more students will graduate sooner. And if students that are ready to go can start earlier while they're still in high school, they can have a semester or two of college under their belt before they graduate, and what that means is a huge increase in affordability, something that we're deeply committed to. To Senator Pratt's point, part of the plan that we've been working on with Commissioner Casilius is to do a better job getting information about what the workforce needs are of the future, where the hot professions are, and to link up an individual student's passions and interests with those jobs of the future sooner. Not to do tracking to create narrowness, but to expand the range of possibilities for students. So the worst thing that can happen is a student never thinks about that question, and she goes off and studies something that might turn out to have no relationship at all to her passions or interests. If we can do a better job earlier on in high school of making that link, we'll have fewer mismatches as students begin their higher education journey, and that will allow for, if you will, fewer missteps, faster time to completion, better use of their resources, growing affordability, and more people to work sooner. There are a very large number of transfers that occur in the state of Minnesota, some of which are the natural progression to the next step, so from Normandale Community College to Metro State or Winona or the University of Minnesota, it makes sense in the progression. But we also see many transfers in the state of Minnesota, not just within MinSCU, but from the University of Minnesota to MinSCU, of students that start off in a college or university on a traditional path and discover their passion is actually in a technical field. And so the better job we can do earlier on in aligning passions and interests with what the options are available to students, I think the better job we'll do in addressing your concern. And that's part of the package of things we've been working on with Commissioner Casilius around the alignment of higher education and high schools.
Chancellor, is there a particular tool that you're using in your analytics that we...
Madam Chair,
go ahead.
At St. Cloud State, we're doing two things. One, we have done some quantitative homegrown metrics looking at kind of the input factors that students bring in. We also bought a product called MapWorks that students take we feed in information about their pre-college characteristics. They also take a self-assessment. We had 82% of our first-year students take that this year, so we combined the two to then strategize our intervention strategies.
Impressive. Thank you. Senator Klassen.
Yeah, Madam Chair. Chancellor, thank you so much for sharing your vision with us today. You've put together a comprehensive plan. It's well thought out. You've shared your vision, and most importantly, you've shared your actions to make that vision a reality. I found a lot of creative things, innovative things in your presentation. I like that you have accountability built into your proposal, and you're not afraid of that. I think, too, that I liked private industry, your involvement with private industry in the state. I believe it's long overdue that we need to have our industry start to invest through mentorships and other types of activities so that they're investing in the education as well and also in their company. Your comments about realigning secondary, post-secondary education, I think, are right on. More opportunities for concurrent enrollment so that students are prepared and they start earning credits earlier in that process. The one thing I would make a recommendation after having been in a partner with the MinSCU Institution on the Perkins Grant, there's a great opportunity there to use that grant and focus on your priorities I often think the Perkins grant, which is several million dollars, is a scattered approach. And I think by focusing your initiatives through that grant and with your secondary partners can be a real asset to, again, helping your vision become reality. So, again, thank you.
Thank you, Chancellor.
Senator Bonhoff, Senator Clausen, thank you for those very kind words and for the excellent suggestion.
I appreciate the attention of the committee and the patience, and thank you very much for your presentation and your leadership. Thanks to all who testified.
Thank you.
Oh, let's see. Oh, members, before I adjourn, you're all done. members, it's Valentine's Day on Thursday, and we have committee. Now, you know, we have an option. We can ignore it and treat it like every other day, or we could share and, you know, consider bringing each other Valentine's. So Valentine's are welcome, you know. But if you bring a Valentine for one, be sure and bring a Valentine for all. Okay. So with that, there being no further business for the committee, the meeting is adjourned.